All right, last week we were talking about this passage of where the love of God is poured out in our hearts through the Holy Spirit who's given to us. And I went down a number of bypaths there, as usual. But I'm going to go on tonight. I think we've got the message pretty straight on the other. I'll make this transitional statement that the presence of the Spirit of God in our hearts is the only link we have to God. You see, we'll never get there by our brain, which is mostly oatmeal, I have come to realize. Especially if you try to get into a discussion with anybody. Got two bowls of mush there. I've had a lot of discussions with people all the time, you know. And this last week, a lot of sessions with different ones. I marvel at any human beings ever get along together because the reasoning power is so ridiculous. You know, you try to get people together and get them to understand one another and so forth, and it just seems like the brain's made out of oatmeal. Can't get things through the thick head. But we're all like that, you know. No one's any exception to it. But it gives me more and more the realization that we think we're pretty smart, but we're not. The most we can do is just let the Spirit of God keep working with us. He's the one that holds us to the truth, not our brilliant brain. Now, if that sounds cynical to you, there's a reason for it. Because it's true. It's true. I'm cynical because I lived long enough to be cynical. About the human capacities. It's just not that dependable. We flash on brilliantly once in a while, but we're just not that dependable. We've got to trust God to teach us. We've got to trust Him to guide us. And you've got decisions to make. You have to put them in His hands and let Him bring that decision out. What I like to suggest to people on this decision making, based on the premise I just got through laying out to you, based on the premise that the human brain is oatmeal for the most part, what I suggest is, if you've got a significant decision to make, let it simmer on the back burner there. Don't try to get too involved in all the reasons, because the reasons are not that clever. One of the problems with human reasoning is that it's too easy for us to keep our viewpoint a little bit warped, say, in the direction we'd like to think. It's too easy to do that. And it's too easy to skip over things we ought to keep in mind. I've told you, like the kid that wants to go down and buy an automobile from Honest Harry's Great Little Cars there, and he finds this chariot that it's really a beautiful candy apple red and whatever, but it's got sawdust in the transmission, things like that. But he's so bent on buying it that he just can't let that affect him. He goes clanking around the block in it, and it sounds like a Rolls Royce. Why? Because his brain is bent on buying that car, and he keeps jumping over the realities. So easy to do. We all do it. You want to make a choice, want to make a decision. It's so easy to jump over those little things that we really ought to stop and think about, because we so much want to do a particular thing. Well, young people getting married do that, in evaluating the person they're going to marry. It's so easy to jump over those little things that we think aren't going to make any difference, and they come back later to haunt us. We knew it all along, but we didn't want to face it, that that's the way it was going to be. I marvel at the way some of these people do this. I mean, the guy, for example, beats a girl up, and then he comes back, "Oh, I'll never do that again, honey." And so she goes and marries him, you know. Well, somehow that brain has jumped over the fact that he beat her up once, he'll probably do it again. Because the brain doesn't always function the way we'd like. So I'm only saying, as I've said to you many times, that we can't depend on our own power to reason. What then do we depend on? Well, we depend on God to get through to us. Not to give us great feelings or anything like that, but we depend upon God to somehow get us through. If identifying with Christ demands much more than just coming before Him and saying, "Help, Lord," if it demands much more than that, we're in trouble. And of course, the fifth chapter of Romans bears this out. We'll get to it later, where it says, if by the trespass of one many are dead, then how much more by the sacrifice of one shall the many be made alive? In other words, our life in God, our acceptance with God, is not based upon our ability to be religious or to do anything right, but upon the fact that just as Adam's sin drew us all into the predicament, so Christ's sacrifice draws us all out of the predicament. No one is going to go to hell because of the sin of Adam. Sometimes people have said to me, well, I don't know how God can hold me responsible for something somebody did 6,000 years ago or whenever it was. And the answer is he doesn't. He's already taken care of that on the cross. Our thing is only to accept it, you see. If a person says, well, I don't want to accept that, then that's their problem. If, like I've said about the house, somebody, kid next door, set your house on fire. When you're in the house and the neighbor comes running over and says, hey, your house is on fire, see? And somebody says, yeah, your boy set the house on fire. And they stand there arguing about who set the fire. And the neighbor is saying, well, look, if your kid set my house on fire, I'm not going to budge out of it. It's not my responsibility. I didn't set it on fire. So they stay in the house and get burned up. See, the point is, it doesn't matter whose fault it was that the house was burning. If you're going to save yourself, you leave it. See? Get out. Now, Christ died for us to provide a cure for the illness of mankind and a recovery because of the sin of Adam. It doesn't make any difference whether we think we ought to be affected by Adam's sin or not. It doesn't make any difference whether we feel Adam ought to be horsewhipped for having given in so easy. None of that matters. The house is on fire. We better walk out. And Christ made the way out. It's pretty simple. It's probably oversimplified as far as the philosopher is concerned, but then that's the way it's got to be. Because I've often said to you, you see, that if faith and salvation is dependent upon the ability to do some theological thinking, you see, to do abstract thinking, then a great part of the world is in trouble. Because a good part of the world is illiterate in the first place. In the second place, people that do read don't always grasp philosophical ideas. I keep saying that over and over because I want you to understand. If somebody hands you a tract and try to read through that tract, you see, and they've got a lot of theological ideas in there that you've got to accept before you can become a Christian, you have to wonder. And you find these tracts with 5 and 6 and 7 and 10 points, you know, and if you do this and you do this and you do this and you do this, then you're saved. But I'm not sure everybody can grasp all of that. Just like the matter of sin, I've said to you many times, I'm not sure a person really understands what sin's all about till they really meet Christ. We can theoretically accept it and say, yes, I'm caught in this human maelstrom and so forth, but the essence of our salvation is not being able to define sin. The essence of salvation is accepting the Savior, that's all. And I've told you over and over again that my starting place with people is not trying to help them clean up their lives so they can present themselves to Jesus. My concern is start talking to Jesus so he can help clean up your life. There are no barriers. The guiltiest sinner on earth can lift their head to Christ and talk to him now, immediately. And they don't have to go through my system of steps to get there. Say, okay, so we've pressed a little further on that, but it's the essence of Romans 5 is what I'm really giving you here, sort of getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I want us to see the point that coming here tonight, as we do week by week, to hear the Word, it gives an opportunity for the Holy Spirit to minister to us in ways that really go beyond our own understanding. If I thought that your salvation and your welfare was based upon my ability as a teacher, I'd be a little bit uneasy about the whole thing. Because I don't know, you know, whether I'm any good as a teacher or not. I come and give you the Word Now, there'd be a lot of people that would think I wasn't any good as a teacher, and that they're welcome to that opinion. People think I repeat myself too much, because I do. I mean, too much in their view. And it's not organized. They don't like that. So there are a lot of people that wouldn't think I was much of a teacher, but that's all right. They can hold that view. But if I'm not depending on being a good teacher here. I'm depending on the idea that I come as a representative of Christ, and I set before you the Word. I call your attention to the Bible, to the Word. I read a few passages here for you, and we talk about things. And I'm trusting the Holy Spirit to communicate to you beyond my capacity to communicate. Have you ever had the experience of reading something or hearing something spoken that triggered ideas in your mind that probably were not exactly what was said or what was written? In other words, you watch a television program. Sometimes you get some pretty good thoughts, and most of the news is faded and jaded and everything else, but still there are thoughts that come. But I've sometimes gotten thoughts, seed thoughts, from some television program or from reading a book, and it grows into something quite different than I'm sure than the author originally intended. But those thoughts come. I was reading lately through the Greek mythologies and pantheon of Greek gods. There's a great host of these Greek gods and goddesses. And so you run into these things over and over again today. There are so many different improvisations in the world of religion that maybe keeping, for my part, as a spokesman, shall I say, for the gospel, keeping up with some of these things helps me to help people sort out what's right and what isn't right, what's dangerous and what isn't. For example, I got a some packet of some papers from a person in the mail here a couple of days ago, and included was a certificate this person had received. They did a lot of writing, and I saw that they were a member of a society. It's a woman who's a member of the Society of Danae, D-A-N-A-E. And this was sent to me with quite a lot of feeling of accomplishment, and I'm not criticizing that. But I looked at that thing and I thought, here's a Christian woman who participates in the Society of Danae. Now, D-A-N-A-E, Dana, was the wife in Greek mythology of Zeus and the mother of Perseus, who was the slayer of the Gorgon, the dragon Medusa, who was the snake-haired goddess. Her whole hair was all snakes, Medusa. But, I mean, here's a person, a Christian woman, who's participating in a society that is identified with one of the ancient Greek goddesses. It's it may be fairly harmless, but it's just one of those things. And saw a restaurant and your town over here called the Goats, you know. And I looked at that and I thought, I'm not going to walk in there because, why? Because there's nothing wrong with a humble goat, but the symbol of the goat is a symbol of Pan, who was the god of the muses and the nymphs. It was frequently honored at the Bacchanalian feasts, and he was a pretty profligate fellow, pretty wild person. So these are all things that you see in our society around us, that people get into, their intentions are good, but they get into things that belong to Satan, and they get in there unwittingly. One has to keep these abreast of all these things. But anyway, what I was going to say to you before is I wouldn't recommend it to everybody to read these kinds of things, but even reading some of these things, thoughts hit me that have nothing to do with what was being said directly, but it sends my mind out on a track that I get some advantage out of. I can take a story of some kind, a novel perhaps, or fiction, and sometimes if it's well done, if I don't want junk, but sometimes some of the great fiction of our literary world has had some pretty good effects. Now, the reason I went into all of that, and it's wandering as usual, but the reason I went into all of that is that coming here to you tonight, I communicate to you what I believe the Lord wants me to say, but I am well aware of the fact that the Spirit might address you with words that are started by me, but the meaning of it comes through to you perhaps even differently than I had myself intended. And maybe the same sentence hits two or three of you in different ways. And it may have quite an effect on your life. You may suddenly think, wait a minute, that's something I should think about a little bit. As we come, I've said to you the word has to be simple. I've said to you that the Spirit of God has got to take this word and apply it to you beyond my capacity to teach you and beyond your capacity as a human being to really process all that God might want to say. While the words that we give, I try to give you meaningful words. I don't just give you a bunch of jargon here. And the thoughts are put together in some effort to be reasonable about it. But I'm really convinced that the Spirit of God has to take the things that are said here and translate them to affect our hearts. Because if I were to come here just to give you an academic lecture, I would have to feel that it might not do very much good for you. All right, well, let's go on now and bring to light some of these things in the fifth of Romans. Verse 6, for while we were yet weak, sick is the Greek word here, while we were yet sick, Christ died on behalf of the ungodly. Now, ungodly here means the irreverent, the irreligious. Not people who are necessarily fighting God. There are lots of people around you that don't have a whole lot of opinion about it one way or the other. They just go on with their daily life, and they're not fighting God, and they're not joining Him. They're just living. So we don't think that they're godless in the sense that they're joining societies of atheists or anything else. But the Greek word here means without worship, without devotion. There are people, many, many people around you that are good people in as human beings go. That is their sort of the live and let live type, and they do their thing each day. They're not fighting anybody, and they're not fighting God necessarily. But they have no basis of devotion. There's no inspiration in their life. There's nothing but the daily routine of earning a living. Most people don't know what to do with their lives. They have no sense that they're doing anything worthwhile at all. They have a little fun once in a while, a few friends. They get through the year, 2 weeks with pay, a few events here and there, a couple of birthday parties, and that's it. That's their life, and they get the feeling of nothingness to it. Do you realize what a marvelous thing it is that there is within you, because of the Spirit of Christ, some commitment to something bigger than you are, something higher, something greater? I'm taking it at its most basic, primitive level here. I realize we have to go on much further than that, but just take it at its first stage, that there's something in your life that is big enough to attract from you devotion, and it kind of gives you something to tie life together with. So let's say going to a meeting once a week, wheresoever that would be, where Christ is honored. There's a measure of devotion in that. There's a measure of commitment. Just to come here, for example, on Tuesday night demands a sort of measure of commitment to something greater than what you have around you. Not because of the teaching, I mean, but because you're coming in the name of Christ. You have a focus on something that lifts you up above the meaningless routine of daily living. The same would be said, of course, for going to worship on Sunday. It gives a kind of anchor to life. Not just going to the club to enjoy a religious lecture, not that kind of thing, but I mean, where people go to worship Christ. There is something in their life that holds it together. That will ultimately be the glue that holds your life together. To find a moment of devotion to Christ in the week. By moment, I'm talking, of course, about a time, a focus, somewhere in a week, that focus. And a reference point for your life. When there is the need of a principle to guide, you're going to make a decision. You need some principles to guide you. There is the need of a focus. And the fact that we have an eternal spirit and we are shooting for something eternal gives us something to work for. One of the things about school, people may forget, young people may forget, is that as long as they're in school, they have a goal out there that gives meaning to their life. One person said to me that they were getting tired of school, college situation. They were going to maybe quit. And this person was pumping gas, I guess, as a job to get himself through school. And I said to him, well, I guess it doesn't really make much difference whether you're going to school or pumping gas. You know, I mean, nothing wrong, of course, with pumping gas, but I mean, if you don't go on with your education, you can look forward to this kind of a job, perhaps for the period of time, maybe for a long time. So I said, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of difference. You got to be occupied with something. You might as well be occupied with school as to be occupied pumping gas. Well, what's the difference? Maybe you got 4 years out ahead of you. You can spend 4 years doing a job, or you can spend 4 years going to school. I'm not saying it's about pumping gas to put it down. I'm just saying that you might as well, or you talk about working in an office or wherever. You might as well spend time in school as to spend the same time working on a job somewhere. Once a young person gets out of school, now they have to face the reality of going to a day-by-day-by-day job somewhere. Now, one happens to be among the fortunate ones that has a job that can be fairly intriguing or interesting or exciting, that's fine. But for most people, going to work every day does not represent a noble venture. It's something you do because you have to support yourself. It's not exciting, it's just there. You don't worry about it. There's nothing wrong with it. Every morning you get up at a certain hour and you get your breakfast, hopefully, and you get off to work. Now, there's a reason to say all of this. Using a very secular illustration, I'm saying to you that a person, let us say, that is in school, on a purely secular basis, has more going for them in terms of meaningful goals than, let's say, a person who's working in an office somewhere. To bring home the bacon every day. You go to work, you earn your money, and you come home and you eat and you go to bed, you know, whatever you do. Now let us say to you that for most people, life is pretty routine. Not many jobs are going to hold your interest so much that each day is a new fascination. It isn't that way. Whether you're selling or you're working with your hands, or whatever you're doing. It's the same old thing every day you go to that job. You punch in or whatever and you punch out. Punch in and punch out, punch in and punch out, until you get pretty punchy with the whole thing. They've said it lightly, but you get punchy. What's new? Yeah, of course, that old expression everybody has. Hello, Charlie, what's new, you know? Nothing's new. Nothing's new. It's all the same old thing every day. Same old work, same old squabbles at home, same old howling cat at night keeping you awake. Everything's the same, day after day, day after day. Or a dog, you know. Now let me say something to you here. It's very gutty. Yes, everything on this earth tends to be pretty much the same. But what is it that gives to the Christian that something special, that something extra that makes life worth living? It is Christ. It is the hope of eternal life. It is the realization that this humdrum routine is not going to be all there is to life. I've said to you before, things have a way of running out of interest. No matter how exciting your job may be, even then it has a way of, the excitement runs out. Same is true with entertainment or whatever it is. Life has a way of just sort of running out on you. And you wind up as one of our famed entertainers, singing, "Is that all there is to life? You know, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is to it?" Well, yeah, that's all there is to it. It's disillusioning. It's disappointing. When you get old enough finally to realize that when you went to the carnival and paid the guy a quarter to guess your weight and he missed it and you thought you had the drop on him, then you come to find out as you get older that he only paid 10 cents for the prize he gave you anyway. There's no way they can lose. Whether they give you a prize or don't give you the prize, they still make a buck. That's a simple little illustration, but it's true. That was a great revelation to me when I was a kid, a young person, and suddenly realized that. I used to go to the midways, you know, like everybody else. And you find out that they can't lose because whatever you've paid them to play their game, you've still paid more than they paid for the prize they give you if you win. So they can't lose, and that's disillusioning to us. But life is like that. Life is disillusioning. But for the Christian, it doesn't matter. So the old car gets old and rusts out. These cars fall apart so fast. It's incredible. We maintain a half a dozen units down there in our outfit, and they're always having to be repaired. The boys spend half... Huh? Yeah, boys have spent half their life fixing the cars down there. But but it doesn't matter how much you pay for the car. How new it is, it wears out. Everything wears out. And life would be very disillusioning, except that out there, beyond this veil of tears, is an eternity of glory that is well worth marking time for down here. See, now in school, we're always looking ahead to the day we get out. I know when I was in school, the same thing. You enroll as a freshman or whatever, and you're plugging through, and always you got your eye on that day you graduate. There may be no greater disillusioning day in the world than the day after graduation. You wake up and you ask yourself, what was it all about? Mom and Dad were so proud of you standing there with your diploma on Friday night, and Monday morning they're kicking you out of bed to go get a job. That's right. And it's really not that much worth waiting for. A girl is going to get married, you see, and she's just counting the days and the hours and the minutes when she's going to get married, you know, and she's going through all these things and buying all the trousseau and everything else, and it's so exciting, you know, and she gets engaged, and she's got 6 months or so to wait if they're going to do that. And everything is just exciting. You can hardly wait till the day she gets married, you see. Then what happens, you know? The day afterward, she wakes up to the fact that now she's got to live it out, you know. Now she's got to make it work. That's right. See, the day afterward, all of a sudden, it hits you. And, of course, there's a lady that's waiting for 9 months to have the little infant. And when the baby hits town, then what is it? It's routine. It's drudgery. 24 hours a day. That's one thing a lot of people don't realize when it comes to having these children, getting married, you see, and a girl's so anxious to get married, wants her little family there. But the thing that happens is, the moment that baby comes, I'm not saying anything against having babies, you know, don't misunderstand. You may take that word from me, but you need to understand, the day that little infant drops in there, that poor lady has 24 hours watch every day, week in and week out, and month in and month out. I think a lot of husbands don't understand that. Can you imagine? This lady can never be free of that infant. Well, I was going to say till it gets out of school, but it's even longer than that. But no, they're never free. 24 hours a day on call, right? And if she goes anywhere, she's got to make arrangements for the kid. She's never free. But that's part of the deal, part of the routine of life. But what I'm saying is, here's this girl, so, everything's so exciting, all the wedding preparations, so great. And then it all hits. Now, if I have left you with one lesson tonight, it's been worth it. That lesson is this. Nothing in the world can be so much worth the waiting for as the eternity with Christ that will not be disappointing. You plow through 5 years, 10 years of schooling, and what you've worked so hard for suddenly doesn't seem so great. But you plow through years and years of the struggle of Christianity, and it's going to be great. It's not going to be disillusioning or disappointing in any way. It's going to be great. And all for the simple point that Christ has taken us in our weakness, and all the disillusionments and all the inadequacies of the human scene. It's a struggle, it's routine, it's a problem, it's all of these things. But he has given us a meaning to life that nothing on earth can give us. So it's worth the struggle, and worth the waiting, and worth the difficulties and the heartaches that we have to pass through. Well, I think we'll stop there.